Previously on Beta.
You're late. Highway was jammed with broken heroes on a last chance power drive.
This would be a terrible house to be drunk in.
From now on, you're Gomer Pyle.
Sir, yes, sir.
Do you think I'm cute, Private Pyle? Do you think I'm funny?
Sir, no, sir.
Then wipe that disgusting grin off your face.
Sir, yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, music journalist Aaron Osman joins us to talk about the legacy of folk singer-songwriter John Prine and his self-titled debut.
Prine never wanted to alienate the listener. He wanted to invite as many people in as possible, I think. And so that's why he wrote such simple yet profound statements through his lyrics.
Also, film critic Ian Nathan on the unique genius of director Guillermo del Toro.
His films seem to be one thing, and then as you more and more you watch them, they become other things, because he's got all these levels. You unpeel them like an onion, and there's another film underneath.
But first...
We were the second generation of rock and roll kids, which meant that we were only the second generation able to play records in the privacy of our own rooms. Up until then, the record player was in the living room in the same piece of furniture that held the TV and radio. If it wasn't for that portable machine, rock and roll might have never happened. A record player in the living room meant kids needed their parents' permission, or at least tolerance, to listen to what they wanted. Without the portable player, the first generation of rock kids would have never gotten Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and Jerry Lee Lewis past their parents.
That's the one and only Stevie Van Zandt reading an excerpt from his memoir, Unrequited Infatuations, Odyssey of a Rock and Roll Consigliere. I don't know about you, but Stevie has accomplished so many things that he makes me feel like a slacker. He's probably most famous for his work as a guitarist with Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band and as the lead member of Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul. But to another generation, he's probably most famous for his magnetic performance as Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. And to yet another group, he's probably best known for his work as a global rights activist and as a popular radio DJ. We caught up with Stevie from his home in Greenwich Village. And as much as I wanted to, we couldn't share one mic for this interview, like he's famous for with Bruce. But he did tell us of how he met and befriended the boss.
Literally the day before the Beatles played a variety show called Ed Sullivan, February 9th, 1964. There were no bands in America virtually. You wouldn't see four or five guys singing and playing. You just never saw that. If you went to your high school dance, it would be an instrumental band. Literally the day after the Beatles played this variety show that 72 million people watched, everybody had a band in the garage. Most of them mercifully stayed there, but about a dozen of us got out into the world. I had a band called The Source, and Bruce had a band called The Castiles, and we all knew each other. There was about a dozen of us, you know, a dozen bands. It was a pretty freaky thing to do to be in a band in those days. It wasn't that common, and you were a separate tribe from what was normal society at that point. You know, we became friendly that way, just from running into each other. But then I used to go up to New York, to Greenwich Village on the weekends, and I'd see bands at the Café Wa, which is still there, Saturday afternoons, because those bands were like a year ahead of us in New Jersey. So you go and you'd steal ideas, and then you'd use them in your band, you know. And I would run into Bruce doing the same thing. So at that point, I think we bonded doubly so, and then soon realized that we were both the only guys we knew for whom rock and roll was everything, you know, was a religion. And, you know, it wasn't going to be a weekend thing for us or a hobby or something, you know, until we went to college or until we went into the military or something like that. It was going to be forever. And at that point, I think that was extremely important to have at least one other person who felt like that, you know. If you had been the only one, you would have figured there's something wrong with me. But if there's two of you, you know, you figure, yeah, maybe you're on to something.
Yeah. And besides playing in several bands with Bruce, you went on to co-found Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. When you weren't writing songs for Southside Johnny, you were often touring with Bruce as a member of the E Street Band. And you actually caught an error in the iconic riff of Born to Run. Can you tell us about that?
Well, he played me his new song, which was Born to Run, and I was very excited about it. And it was quite different from what he had been doing. Played it for me, and I was very, very impressed. And I just said to him, I said, you know, I love that minor chord change, you know. And he was like, what minor chord change? You know, there's no minor chord change. And I said, of course there is. It's obvious, you know. So I played him what I was hearing, which was not what he was playing. What he thought he was playing, and they had been working on it so long that they were kind of hearing what they wanted to hear. You know, they were, you know, they what they thought they were hearing at that point wasn't there, and I just pointed out the fact that you could hear the note from where he was bending from, but you did not hear the note that he was bending to. And so they had to redo the mix and redo the guitar parts, and you know, and he credits me with saving his career at that point, and it wouldn't be the last time.
Very well said. You also arranged the horn charts for another great song on the Born to Run album, 10th Avenue Freeze Out. What's the origin story behind that?
I was extremely disappointed, you know, with the basic sound of the 70s studios. They were the worst time to record. You know, we were fighting our whole lives, you know, at that point, what, 10 years to get into a recording studio and get into the business. We were, you know, what we were hoping for, and now he was in the business, and I'm like, man, this is what we were fighting for, this is what we were hoping for, you know, all those years. And it was really disappointing, you know, because this sounded terrible. And on top of it sounding terrible because of all the padding that had in this was the thing to do in the 70s, the horn chart just wasn't any good. So he just, you know, he just asked me my opinion. I said, this really sucks. And he said, go in and fix it. And so I did. It was simple as that. I had already been arranging horns with the Jukes, obviously. So it came very naturally to me. And the horn players were just glad to get out of there, I think, you know, with their lives.
And we're thankful to, I think we're all listeners and fans are thankful to you for changing the horn chart, because I didn't hear the original version, but your version is great. It's like just a great arrangement. Besides your music career, you're best known for your acting. You played mob consigliere and strip club owner Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. How did that happen?
Well, the simple story is... David Chase is looking around for new faces and new ideas for his what was intended to be his final TV show. He wanted to get into the movie business. He'd been in TV for I don't know how long, 20, 30 years by then. So he was very open-minded, let's say, and saw me inducting the Rascals into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by some chance, by an extreme... bizarre circumstance, which I delineate, you know, in the book. I talk about the 10 or whatever it was crazy things that had to happen for me to get that gig. 10 extremely bizarre twists of fate. Anyway, but the bottom line was he happened to be watching TV. He happened to see that thing and he said, let's get him on the show. And that was it.
Yeah. You actually wrote a fictional backstory for Silvio. Can you tell us what it said?
You know, my own philosophy of acting at that point, I wasn't an actor, and I'd seen, my wife is a legitimate actor, and I'd seen her you know, she'd been going to classes for years, and you know, she'd tell me about her classes, and some of that philosophy I agreed with, and some I really didn't understand. So in the end, I had to make up my own. And so I wrote a backstory that him, Silvio and Tony had grown up together. Of course, not even considering the fact that I was, you know, 20 years older than him, because in my mind, I'm always 35. and the basic personality traits that I have, which are not wanting to be in the spotlight, not wanting to be the front man. So in this case, Silvio grew up watching Tony's back as a sort of a best friend.
I know you said you were a kid, Tom. Frankly, you got a problem with authority. This attitude of yours, it's a lot of what's made you an effective leader. But we all got flaws, even you. Seven deadly sins, and yours is pride.
It didn't start off that way, but that's how the relationship ended up turning into. Because at first, it was sort of vague because my character wasn't in the pilot. Hmm. You know, David cast me as Tony Soprano, and HBO wouldn't let him cast me as Tony Soprano, wisely so. And then he said to me, what do you want to play? And I said, you know, I really feel guilty taking an actor's job at this point. So he said, okay, I'll write you in a part that doesn't exist. And so he said, what do you want to do? And I had this treatment about this Silvio Dante that was a independent hitman and ran a Copacabana type of club with the big bands and the Catskills type Jewish comics and dancing girls and that whole schmear, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was like, wow, that sounds interesting. And, you know, came back 2 days later after talking to HBO and said, we can't afford it. So we'll make it a strip club and you'll run the strip club for the family. And that was it. It was kind of vague as to what my position was, other than running the strip club for the family. And of course, that back room would be the office for the family. I think David picked up on the fact that me and Jimmy were bonding off screen. I think based on the fact that neither one of us particularly liked the spotlight. And both of us were kind of, you know, he was a character actor. I was more of a side man. And had that similar kind of, you know, sensibility.
Let me tell you something I never told anybody. Back when Jackie was at the end, he floated the idea of me stepping up to the big seat. Not Tony, me.
Really?
Yeah. But I thought, it's not for me.
Still, you wouldn't sneeze at it.
I never saw myself as that kind of guy. You know, I'm more behind the scenes. Advice. Strategy.
And here you are, Sil. The times make the man, honey. Not the other way around.
And that was very, very comfortable for me because it was similar to what I'd been doing my whole life with Bruce, you know?
Yeah.
What's fascinating to me, and I don't even think this is in the book, because I think it occurred to me doing these interviews, you know, David Chase is extremely detailed. He doesn't miss anything. For some reason, he did not write in a part for either a consigliere or an underboss, you know? Mm. Well, that didn't exist. Hmm. Now, why is that weird? Because he created 15 interesting characters, and in a mob family, consigliere / underboss is an extremely important position.
Yeah.
So suddenly, you know, I kind of just filled that vacuum. Some kind of weird, you know, weird destiny.
Yeah. Lucky for him and lucky for us to get to watch you as Silvio.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah, it works really well. You've been a part of rock history, and as you've told me earlier, you've saved Bruce Springsteen's career and life many times. You've been a part of television history and are a big advocate for social justice across the globe. Out of all of these, which of these are you most proud of?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I'm most proud of probably my teachrock.org music history curriculum, which is going to be, I think, an important way of if it continues to get disseminated, you know, if people really continue to use it and it really gets more widely accepted, we're already being used by like 40,000 teachers and dozens of partner schools. So it's going quite well. If it keeps going this well, I think we will transform the educational process entirely by integrating the arts into the basic disciplines, not art as an after-school class, not art as an extra class, but art in science. Combine art with math, with engineering, and with technology. And if we keep going the way we're going, I think that's got a shot at completely transforming the entire educational experience. So that's the main thing I'm proud of. And also my radio formats, I think, are extremely important, both of them. Basically capturing and sharing and making accessible the greatest music ever made, which I really feel strongly about, is quite finite. I feel our Renaissance was quite finite. I don't. It's not like it's continuing. You know, the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. I think will always be the period that is studied for hundreds of years to come. You know, that needs to be accessible for future generations. So I'm proud of those things.
Yeah, and well, you should be. Stevie Van Zandt, thank you very much for the great conversation. Congratulations on Unrequited Infatuations. We can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you, my friend. Good talking to you.
Stevie Van Zandt is the author of the memoir Unrequited Infatuations. He's also a musician, actor, radio host, and activist. You can find out more about Stevie and his work at WPR.org/beta.
Prine never wanted to alienate the listener. He wanted to invite as many people in as possible, I think. And so that's why he wrote such simple yet profound statements through his lyrics.
Coming up, music journalist Aaron Osman joins us to talk about the great folk singer-songwriter John Prine. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The great singer-songwriter John Prine has been described as the Cliff Clavin of folk music.
What's up with that?
You may be wondering, by who? By me. Aren't you listening? Why do I call him that? Because for a while, John worked as a mailman, and Cliff Clavin is the most famous mailman I can think of. John often came up with ideas for his songs while he was working for the Postal Service. So says Erin Osman. She's a music journalist and the author of the book, John Prine. John's self-titled debut album was released 50 years ago and is still influential. Erin talked with Beta's Steve Gotcher about John's journey from Western Kentucky to the folk scene in Chicago and beyond, to his status as one of the greatest American singer-songwriters ever.
John tended to write directly from his life, directly from his day-to-day experiences. That's sort of a mark of his work that I think is really important, because he tended to illuminate these people and characters and places that had never been celebrated in song before. Like when we think about songs like 6 o'clock News on the self-titled album, that story comes directly from a kid he grew up with in Maywood.
All around the schoolyard, playing all the games, running, laughing, back and forth, the kid with two first names. Stranger in the closet, lock the diary, the past is running faster, singing harmony.
That's drawn directly from his experiences visiting family in Muhlenberg County. When we think of Far From Me, a lot of that kind of heartbreak and sadness in that song is drawn directly from Prine's first girlfriend, like childhood girlfriend, who worked at a local cafe, who really broke his heart. That's really what he was doing. He wasn't trying to make great works of fiction, but he sort of just borrowed from his day-to-day life and translated that into really striking lyrics that have this poetic clarity that I think really resonates with the listener.
But there is a song like Donald and Lydia that isn't really a true story, is it?
No, I mean, that song was drawn from Prine's time in boot camp in Louisiana. And he lived in the barracks, obviously, in boot camp, and in these kind of army towns that are set up all over the world, there tends to be, you know, like a few services adjacent to the barracks, but it's pretty bare bones, these little towns. And so he imagined a soldier, Donald, who was like him and his friends, kind of laying in the barracks, shaved heads, bunk beds, right? And then he imagined a woman who worked in the adjacent town, and kind of how they're both very different people and they never really meet, but they have the same shared sense of longing for love and acceptance, right, in society. And again, that's like another example of Prine sort of illuminating these characters who aren't talked about a lot or aren't celebrated or represented.
But dreaming just comes natural, like the first breath from a baby, like sunshine feeding daisies, like the love hidden deep in your heart.
So what do you think is the secret to John Prine's songwriting? His songs were so unique and so relatable. How did he do that? You know?
I think he did it because he kept it simple. When we think about like great Midwestern songwriters, of course, like Bob Dylan comes to mind. But and a lot of people compared Prine and Bob Dylan whenever this self-titled album came out. But with Prine, there was just such a sense of simplicity and modesty, kind of this desire to kind of get down one-to-one with folks. Prine never wanted to alienate the listener. He wanted to invite as many people in as possible, I think. And so that's why he wrote such simple yet profound statements through his lyrics. And I also think that, you know, maybe he just was writing the way that he would speak. You know, he wasn't like a fancy guy. He came from a modest background. And I think that informed who he was as a person, and he never got away from that.
Now, we talked a bit about Paradise before, but tell me a little bit more about that song, because it's so powerful.
Yeah, it really is. And I think, you know, maybe like new listeners especially, but I think a lot of folks consider this song like a parable or something, but actually it's true. It's taken from true events that took down the town of Paradise, Kentucky. It's where Prine's family was from, on both sides, actually. His mom and his dad's sides were both from Muhlenberg County in Kentucky. He spent summers and varying holidays going down there to kind of hang out with his extended kin. And over the years, he witnessed the destruction of that, like, very beautiful ancestral land by corporate coal mining. All of the lyrics from that song are basically taken directly from the papers. And directly from Prine's observations of the destruction of this town.
And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Prine felt moved and felt sad enough and felt a poignancy to kind of capture that. And also, you know, it was a song for his father. His father loved that part of the world, a part of our country. And so he wrote it for his dad, and he wrote it to sort of convey his sadness and his frustration with corporate destruction.
Now let's back up and talk a little bit about John's history. The Old Town School of Folk Music played a role in developing John as a musician. How big of an impact did that have in helping him find his way?
The Old Town School of Folk Music is a very important and prestigious folk music school in Chicago. I think of it as like the preeminent folk music school in our country. And John was introduced to it through his older brother, Dave Prine, who's the oldest of the four Prine brothers, was really swept up in the folk music revival in Chicago. He loved like the new Lost City Ramblers and folks like that. And so he started taking lessons at OTS. And eventually he said, John, you know, I've taught you a couple chords. You seem very interested in this. Like, why don't you come to the school? Like, why don't you come and learn? His teacher, Ray Tate, who was the lead guitar teacher at OTS at the time, described Prine as a very focused, dedicated student who really wanted to learn finger picking and finger style guitar. And Prine's local discovery in the club scene actually came as a product of OTS. Ray Tate and some other teachers at OTS founded a club called the Fifth Peg. It was across the street from the OTS location in Lincoln Park. And Ray Tate is the first person that ever put Prine up on the stage. And that's sort of how people, locals, discovered that John Prine, this unassuming mailman in the suburbs, was writing these amazing songs.
Now, a young movie critic for the Chicago Sun-Times by the name of Roger Ebert had a role in spreading the word about John Prine. How did that happen?
Yeah. In the 60s and 70s, Old Town was the hub of Chicago bohemia. It was the hub of the folk music scene. It was the hub of sort of underground comedy and theater troupes. And it's where all the hippies and, you know, all the cool people hung out. And Roger Ebert was very much a part of that scene. He was the local arts critic, and he definitely hung out at the bars in Old Town, you know, ordering beer and shot specials and, you know, hanging out with folks like Shel Silverstein and Studs Terkel and, you know, all the folks, the literati on the scene. So yeah, Roger had gone to see a film to potentially review, and he thought it was so rotten that he walked out. And instead, he walked down to the Fifth Peg and happened upon Prine. You know, he didn't write about music. That wasn't his beat. But after he saw Prine's set, he felt moved enough to sort of share the news of a new local talent. And so instead of his Friday movie review, he reviewed Prine's set at the Fifth Peg. And from there, all of Chicago took notice, because by then, Roger was a respected critic, right? And he was a Chicago personality, and that made Chicagoans take notice. And so, of course, after Roger's review, folks started trickling in. You know, they wanted to be at the feet of the singing mailman. You know, there's a lot of intrigue there.
Yeah. And speaking of people who Chicago loves, Steve Goodman was a good friend of John Prine's. And Goodman did some things to help advance John's career. What kind of things did he do?
Oh, man. Yeah. Steve and John were thick as thieves. They were so close. And the thing to know about them is they were sort of like mirror twins in a way. Like, Steve was a born performer. He had like a great personality. He was super outgoing, and he was just a showman. Whereas Prine, John Prine, was more introverted, a little more shy, a little more of a reluctant performer. And so I think they really complemented each other in that way. But Steve really encouraged Prine. He really pushed him to sort of look beyond the Chicago club scene. So he did a couple of things. One, he convinced Kris Kristofferson to go check out Prine's set one night after hours. Then he convinced Prine to go to New York to record some demos. They had an offer from the Canadian pop star Paul Anka, offered to fly the pair out to go record some demos in New York, and was like, hey, kids, I'm going to help get you a record deal. And Prine was kind of like, why would I do that? I'm happy here. And Steve Goodman was kind of like, are you nuts? Like, of course we're going to New York. So he really was like the enthusiast, and he really pushed Prine out of his comfort zone in those early days. And without Steve Goodman's sort of enthusiasm and goodwill toward his friend, I'm not sure, you know, if any of this would have happened as quickly for Prine as it did.
Right. And the amazing thing is, not only was Steve so selfless, but Kris Kristofferson really put himself out for John Prine. What kind of things did he do?
Yeah. So the big sort of transformative moment with Kristofferson was when they got to New York to record those demos. Steve and John got off the plane and they picked up a copy of the Village Voice at the airport. And they saw that Kris Kristofferson was playing at the Bitter End that night. And they were like, wow, this is, you know, what a coincidence. So of course they headed to Greenwich Village to go check out the set. And when they got there, Kristofferson saw them in the street, came over and said, you guys got to open for me. So he insisted that Steve and John each do a couple of songs to open. But what he didn't tell them, and I don't know if it's because he didn't know or because he just didn't want to freak them out, was that it was sort of a label showcase that night. There were label representatives in the audience. And so what ended up happening is Jerry Wexler from Atlantic Records was in the audience at the Bitter End, and he decided to sign Prine. It was their first folk artist signing, and it happened because of Kris Kristofferson's generosity.
Well, once he got to New York City and he was signed to Atlantic Records, they sent him to Memphis to record his first album, John Prine, at American Sound Studios. And the backup band for the recording was a group called the Memphis Boys, who were the Memphis equivalent of L.A.'s famous session band, the Wrecking Crew. And they didn't have any experience with folk music, but they found arrangements that worked well with Prine's writing. How were they able to do that?
Yeah, it's all pretty amazing because, you know, as you said, they didn't have a lot of experience playing with folk musicians. They'd played on some country records, so that helped. Like, they were certainly capable of the country portion of Prine's repertoire. But then the producer, Arif Mardran, had never produced a folk record. So everyone was green, in a sense, in this session. But the great thing about the Memphis Boys is that they're total professionals. They know that they are hired by record labels to make hits, right? And if they don't deliver on that, then they failed. They work really hard to sort of service the songs that are given to them. You know, the way that they describe it is they play by feel. They kind of fall in together and just try to foster the song as much as they could. And they knew, and they knew correctly, that Prine's stuff was really about the lyrics, right? So eventually they all kind of dove into the lyrics and paid close attention to the lyrics and tried to highlight the words as much as they could.
Is there a particular song you think that highlights how well the band fit into John's music?
Yeah, I mean, I really like what they did on Far From Me. Far From Me is my favorite song on this album. And I think it's just because it translates as such a classic country song. And I think that's what those lyrics necessitate. But it's got this timelessness, and it has this poignancy and this sadness that I think just is really universal. And I think from the production side, they really did a good job highlighting that.
And the sky is black and still now on the hill. Looks just like a diamond ring, but it's far, far from me.
Now, you mentioned a song that you thought was your favorite song, and I have to say that for me, Angel from Montgomery is one of the greatest songs, the best songs ever written. I don't know if you agree with that or if you feel as strongly as I do, but what do you think makes that song so powerful and so unique?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Angel for Montgomery is such an incredible song, and it definitely is in the Great American Songbook at this point. You know, it's a standard. And I think something that really makes it stand out is, A, it's an example of Prine's deep empathy for sort of populations or people that aren't him, but who he sort of observes and feels for. And particularly in this song, you know, he was like 20 years old, writing about a middle-aged woman who feels older than she is.
I am an old woman named after my mother. My old man is another child that's grown old. If dreams were lightning, thunder were desire, this old house would have burnt down a long time ago.
I don't think people think of feminism when they think of John Prine, but I think this song in particular just is an example of his tacit sort of implied feminism because, you know, she's singing in the first person.
How do you think John Prine's going to be remembered in future generations?
As one of the greatest songwriters that's ever lived. And I think that the reason for that is that any new songwriter that you're a fan of, that any of us are fans of, will always cite John Prine, will always be influenced by John Prine, will always be in awe of John Prine, because nobody can do what he did. People try, but no one will ever touch the guy. And I think that's why he will be constantly in the conversation. He's a perpetual source of inspiration for musicians and writers.
Well, Aaron Ossman, it's a great pleasure to talk to you again. Your book is brilliant. I look forward to the next one. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Aaron Ossman is a music journalist and the author of the book, John Prine. She talked with Steve Gotcher. You can find out more at wpr.org/beta.
Raising beams of incredible dreams, now quiet man.
Now, all the films are connected by this concept of monster, but he always says that in everything he's made, the true monster is the human being.
Film critic Ian Nathan joins us to talk about the visionary director, Guillermo del Toro. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're looking for fantastical films that are unlike any others, you should check out Guillermo del Toro. He's responsible for some of the most visually sumptuous scenes and charismatic characters in modern cinema. Guillermo's resume includes the Academy Award-winning Pan's Labyrinth and The Shape of Water. Ian Nathan is one of the United Kingdom's best-known film critics and writers. His latest book is called Guillermo del Toro, The Iconic Filmmaker and His Work. Ian says that Guillermo himself is as layered and epic as his movies, and that talking with him is like stepping into a waterfall.
He's got such an extraordinary mind and a capacity for detail and a kind of tendency for detail that you ask him one thing and he'll answer 20 different things. You know, every film he's made is built up from a sort of cornucopia of references to other films, books, comic books he read as a child, his own personal childhood. So there are so many things in his head that the slightest question, you know, why did you make this film, will give you an enormous answer. Long-winded, he loves to talk. He's one of those directors who's almost sort of biographize themselves as they go along. They write their own biography with every interview question.
Yeah. Two of Guillermo's biggest influences are Alfred Hitchcock and Luis Buñuel. How have they influenced his films?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think what you have is the two sides of del Toro's muse, if you want, with Hitchcock is the guy who is the trickster, the guy who plays with plot and suspense, who loves to frighten his audience, but also is fascinated with human psychology and corruption and where murder comes from, the dark side of things. Buñuel is the great Spanish director who is a surrealist. He's much more thematic. He's full of sort of politics and religion. But religion is a very big part of del Toro's life and his art. I mean, he calls himself a lapsed Catholic, a Catholic atheist. But that still goes on in his head, you know, that relationship with the past.
No, men, they'll need these.
Are you a Catholic?
Yes, among other things. But that's hardly the point.
Well, you're going to need one of these.
I abhor the use of violence. Thank you. I wouldn't want you to think me mad, Sergeant Whitman.
No, 3 days too late for that, Professor Froome. All right, you guys, let's move.
And also, yeah, he's a child of two languages. He comes from Mexico, where they speak Spanish. He grew up speaking Spanish, and that is the language of Buñuel. But he watched American movies, and he loves American movies. Now he lives in L.A. The English language that comes through Hitchcock is that side of him. It's that kind of split mind he has between the two directors.
While Guillermo was writing the screenplay for his third film, The Devil's Backbone, he experienced the biggest crisis of his life. What happened?
Yeah, absolutely. It's enough to shake anyone up, but it had a huge influence on his life and art, was that while he went off to America to make his first forays into Hollywood, films like Mimic, his father was kidnapped. I think, as he put it, they thought I was a rich man, thought I'd become this rich director. So his father was targeted and kidnapped. And for about 30-something days, he was held captive by criminals. And Guillermo del Toro and his brother had to negotiate with these criminals. I mean, he was absolutely terrifying. You can't imagine what it's like to be on the other end of that. In fact, it's really interesting. He'd made a friendship with James Cameron early on in his career. And it was James Cameron who paid for the negotiator, an actual professional hostage negotiator, was brought in to help Guillermo negotiate with these kidnappers. And in the end, they paid them off. They got the money. And this is an extraordinary story he tells of having to drop the money off and all these kind of mistakes that were made. The directions were wrong and the drivers wouldn't go to places. If it wasn't so horribly real, it would be comical. That idea and that story, I think, has stayed with him and has fed into his work. Fathers and sons is a big theme that continues throughout his films. And I think he was profoundly changed by that experience.
Interesting. Guillermo views all of the films he's made as a single movie. And I find this very interesting. Can you explain his unified theory?
Yeah, it's something about the way he works. I think it would be too literal to say they all belong to the same universe, rather like Marvel, and they're interconnected. He doesn't work quite like that. What I think he means is they are extensions thematically of one another. And obviously they all originate from him as an artist. So all of them are to some extent fairy tales. He grew up reading fairy tales and he's very influenced by that idea of storytelling on a very metaphorical level. And he invests that into his work. And they all are portrayals often of children. And I think he feels a child. I think that's his worldview is very much like a child's worldview. So I think when he says they are one film, it's very much about the underlying things that inspire him and move him to make films. What choices he makes is very much built upon the films he's made in the past. And within the work, you can see connective tissue, even if it's not directly. You can see that The Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth, and to an extent, The Shape of Water, belong together as a trilogy of very personal, particular stories about exiles and love and connection and monsters. I mean, all the films are connected by this concept of monster. But he always says that in everything he's made, the true monster is the human being. The literal monster in his films often is a much more intriguing prospect. But actually, it's the fascists in Pan's Labyrinth who are, and in Devil's Backbone, who are the actual monsters.
Mm-hmm. What makes Pan's Labyrinth so special?
I suppose one of the things is it sort of draws back to this concept of fairy tale that we were talking about and childhood. But he marries it together with a fantastic depiction of fascism at work. In the officer, in the captain we meet in it, who embodies this kind of cruelty of what was going on in Spain during the Spanish Civil War.
Déjame ver. Déjame ver. ¿Puedes hablar? Joder.
The heart of him, I think, as a filmmaker, Del Toro, you know, this came from a very personal place. And even though, you know, he's Mexican, but Spain has this very intimate connection with Mexico for historical reasons. So he's very connected to Spain. It was an incredibly difficult shoot. I think he struggled with the local crew. They had weather problems. They had technical problems in terms of pulling off the magical, fantastical elements of the film. But something out of that trial by movie was born, and it's a beautifully expressive film, very sensitively done. You know, relationship between the two mothers and the one girl, her literal mother and the housekeeper who becomes her sort of surrogate mother, her relationship with the fawn. And yeah, you look at the films and you think of, you know, where is Del Toro in the film? And he's kind of the fawn. He's the trickster who sets the challenges. You know, he's the director of the drama. But also he's Ophelia, the girl who answers those challenges. And it's full of wonderful sort of references to everything. Alice in Wonderland and Grimm Tales and, you know, all that kind of side. There's a film called Spirit of the Beehive. It's a lovely Spanish film, which was hugely important to him in making Pan's Labyrinth, which is a depiction of very young girls who see Frankenstein on the cinema screen, the original 1931 Frankenstein, and start to believe Frankenstein is out there in the world. And that had such a profound effect on Del Toro when he saw it. In a way, he's sort of paying tribute to that film, which is very much part of his work, films as tributes to other films.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. The New York Times has described Pan's Labyrinth as a political fable in the guise of a fairy tale, or maybe it's the other way around. Which do you think it is?
I'd like to believe it's a fairy tale first, and it's a metaphor there for the Spanish Civil War. Clearly, it's set in a very real historical context, but you know, this is kind of underlying idea, isn't there, within Pan's Labyrinth, that maybe it's all in her head. Maybe she is dreaming up the fawn and she is dreaming up this fantastical world just in the woods as a reaction to the trauma of having to move in with this terrible father. But Del Toro says there are elements in it that where he puts it down for certain that magic is at work. You know, this is Del Toro. He believes in magic. So finally, he says there are things you can find in it that for certain say that there is a magical universe. So I kind of tend to look at it, yes, it's a fairy tale first. The fantasy, if you want, is real within it. Because all great fairy tales are metaphors for puberty and for growing up, and their metaphors for the corruption in the world and all these things he wanted to put in. But the joy of the film is that he plugs the two things in together. He plugs a dark historical thriller about a terrible piece of history into this extraordinary fairy tale universe that he creates. The world of the fairies buzzing around, the fawn and the challenges, you know, and that incredible creature with the eyes, he, you know, on a plate and he puts into his hands. And in a way, he's a metaphor for Spain, you know, the greed of Spain, you know, for the upper classes and abandoning, you know, the peasants. You know, these wonderful kind of levels in which the film operates.
Mm-hmm. Guillermo's 2017 film, The Shape of Water, won 4 Academy Awards for Best Score, Best Production Design, Best Director, and Best Picture. You say that The Shape of Water inhabits a border country where realism and surrealism meet. I love that description. Can you expand on that?
Well, this, I think, speaks for a lot of how Del Toro works. He has a foot in either camp, or in many camps, if you want, with different genres. He doesn't stick to one thing. You know, his films seem to be one thing, and then as you more and more you watch them, they become other things, because he's got all these levels. You unpeel them like an onion, and there's another film underneath. Like we were saying in Pan's Labyrinth, you have the war story, and you have the fairy tale. And with The Shape of Water, I think that's magnified. Yeah, he was doing a tribute to The Creature from the Black Lagoon. He was inverting a monster movie into a romance. And that was kind of, he's always doing everything back to front. But he was doing a film within that about bringing people together, about inclusion. You know, he was sort of attacking Trump's universe at the time by saying, actually, look, you know, people can fall in love across species, you know, levels. It's about coming together, this film.
I'm looking. You've never quite hit me. When he looks at me, the way he looks at me, he doesn't know what I lack or how I am incomplete. He sees me for what I am, as I am.
And then there is the Michael Shannon character, who is, you know, a corrupted separating force. He's the fascist, you know, within this universe of it. You know, he always operates on this metaphorical level, that for every creature, for every fantastical element, and he backs them up. He says, I love monsters and I want to do monsters. But he builds meaning into their presence. You know, he won't let them just be a ghoul within his story. You know, he wants them to have this resonance. And I think he wants us to see ourselves in these creatures.
Mm-hmm. Guillermo's next film is a film noir called Nightmare Alley, but I'm thinking this is not going to be your typical film noir. What do you think his take on noir will be like?
Well, this is fascinating, and I'm so intrigued. Yeah, he's always talked about film noir as something he would love to do. As, you know, again, he's completely imbued in the history of film noir, knows those films backwards, and loves the way it's stylishly done. But strictly speaking, film noir are thrillers. They're not fantastical. Sometimes they border a little bit on horror, but they are rational films, you know, about irrational people.
Mm-hmm.
So you would suggest on the surface that, you know, maybe he's dropping the magic for once. You know, is he not doing monsters? But the more you look into the story of Nightmare Alley, and there's a novel it was based on, and there is a previous film version of it made in 1947, it's not quite as simple as that. It's a film, a lot of it's about carnies in the 1930s, about con men, and about, you know, the crazy array of creatures and people that come with a travelling carnival. There's a film, a very famous film called Freaks from the 1930s, which was banned at the time because they used real, what were thought of at the time as circus freaks. And he's very influenced by that. So I think he's really going to lean in to the carnival element of it. Plus, it's a story about the tarot. It's there are tarot readers in the film. And if you read the book, all the chapters relate to a different tarot card. So there's this kind of idea of destiny and prophecy that goes, that sort of hovers over the story. And Del Toro's mother was a tarot reader, and she fully believed in it. And she taught him how to use the decks of tarot. So it's a very personal story, again. It relates to his mother. So I think it's going to be, on one level, a film noir thriller about a con man whose con turns on him. But at the same time, I think it's going to be filled with a lot of those familiar Del Toro forces. You know, magic will run just beneath the surface.
Yes. Ian Nathan, thank you very much for the great conversation. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And you, thank you very much.
Ian Nathan is the author of Guillermo del Toro, the iconic filmmaker and his work. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Stevie Van Zandt, Aaron Osman, and Ian Nathan. If you want to hear it again, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. Here at Beta, we pride ourselves on our re-listenability. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Frankly, you've got a problem with authority.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I never saw myself as that kind of guy. I'm more behind the scenes.
And thanks to you, our Alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.